Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Well, it's Memorial Day weekend starting later today, right? And it will be the weirdest Memorial Day weekend most of us will ever have experienced. If you're newly unemployed, like almost 900,000 people in New York City alone over the last 2 months, what do you do differently with another 3 days off? If you're working from home and generally staying home, what do you do for a three-day weekend under the same roof as your two-day weekends? If you're an essential worker, delivering for Amazon or cleaning apartment buildings or working in a hospital, or you're an NYPD officer or a firefighter and you get the 3 days, do you go out and interact some more or take your turn to just stay home and chill without exposures? Or what? What a weird Memorial Day weekend. Later this hour, we'll talk to state senators from Long Island and the Jersey Shore about the weird politics and uncertain safety of the suburban beaches being open for the holiday for swimming, while the city isn't. The city beaches are not. Then we'll talk to Mayor de Blasio about the mismatch of keeping city beaches closed. He says you can bring a chair, but you can't swim, but you can bring a chair, but it shouldn't be like normally, like when you're on the beach. What exactly is he talking about? So when the city is keeping beaches somewhat closed, when Long Island is trying to keep city people out, we'll get into all of that. And as we pause, hopefully to remember our war dead, the real reason for Memorial Day, let's also this year remember the 123 MTA workers who have died from COVID-19, according to the latest stat released yesterday. At least 89 nursing home employees in New Jersey and all the other frontline workers and all the other lines of work who may have gotten their deadly cases of the virus as they enlisted or were drafted to keep society going, like soldiers in a war. And, of course, all the civilian casualties who we don't officially mourn on Memorial Day, but probably should, the bystanders in humanity's wars who are in the wrong place at the wrong time, right? Today we can say people in jails and prisons, nursing homes and other long-term care facilities, workers in meat processing plants. That's who the president used the Defense Production Act to force to remain at work nationwide. More hamburgers, billions and billions served as more essential than H95s for all, for example. And a new study from Columbia University suggests 80% of the nation's deaths could have been prevented, 80%, if the country had gone to its full social distancing crouch just 2 weeks earlier. 36,000 people could have been saved if just 1 week earlier, according to that model. So it's the weirdest Memorial Day weekend ever, but one of the most poignant in the lifetime of anyone alive today, right? Joining me now, Mara Gay, member of the New York Times editorial board, herself recovering from COVID-19. Maybe you saw her article about that in the Times. We'll talk about that and more. Hi, Mara. Always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And listeners, as we head into Memorial Day weekend, what do you plan to do with your three-day weekend? And is there anyone you would like to acknowledge, military dead from a past war or a present one, or warrior against COVID-19? 646-435-7280, as we open the lines right from the beginning of the show today. As we head into Memorial Day weekend, what do you plan to do with this weirdest three-day weekend ever? And is there anyone you would like to acknowledge for the holiday, military dead or warrior against COVID-19, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or you can tweet your weekend plans or your memorial at Brian Lehrer. Mark, can I start with you for Memorial Day with some of the individual people you called by their names in your article? You named Idris Bey, age 60, a U.S. Marine and New York City emergency medical technician instructor. You named Rana Zoe Mungin, only age 30, a New York City social studies teacher. And Valentine Blackhorse, 28, from Arizona, who dreamed of leading the Navajo Nation. You want to say on the radio why you chose any of them and say anything about those few individuals that you'd like to add?
Yeah, thank you, Brian. I spoke about those three people because they became sick at the same time that I did. And as I began to recover, unfortunately and tragically, each of them died. And in addition to that, the three of them were all racial minorities, Black and in this case, Indigenous, and Latinx. And I am extremely heartbroken by all the deaths and all the people we've lost. But I think it's really important that we keep in mind that the people who've been, the families and communities who've been the hardest hit are Black and Brown and Indigenous. And I think part of our response and the failure to respond properly to the pandemic is because, unfortunately, it's been associated with deaths in those communities. And oftentimes, as I point out in my column, those lives are not given the value that white lives are in this country. And even though Americans of all backgrounds are suffering because the pandemic has become associated with Black and Brown people, I think that is part of why we've failed to respond to it properly. And so they are on my mind this weekend, and their families are on my mind. And I just am guilty and grateful and relieved and trying to pay it forward on their behalf.
So what would paying it forward look like right now on a policy or societal level? Going forward, what would racial justice, what would social justice, like from today on?
Yeah. So a couple of things. In the immediate, in the near future, I am extremely focused and concerned about the fact that, you know, we still do have new infections. And in terms of the pandemic response, I feel very strongly here in New York and elsewhere that communities of color and people living in poverty need extremely aggressive measures, not from police, but from a medical perspective, to help cut down deaths and transmission. So that in New York, for example, could mean making sure that we have much better community health clinics that are available to people. It's really not enough to tell people to just stay home. And I think this is a virus that can become deadly very quickly. So the idea is to get people oximeters to monitor their blood oxygen level in the event they become sick. It's to make sure that even people who don't have healthcare have access very quickly to a doctor to just answer some basic questions, figure out when they need to come in earlier so that they can get the help they need before it's too late. And obviously making sure that there's safe housing options available to people so that they don't have to quarantine on top of one another, which increases transmission, especially in, we found here in New York, in immigrant communities, and in NYCHA apartments, where many families are sometimes doubled up or tripled up in one apartment. So that's in the near future. And I think, you know, longer term, this is really a slow rolling crisis that the pandemic has pulled back the shades on. I mean, the inequality that already has been a part of this country for so long and has gotten worse has just been really tragically revealed in this crisis. And I think here in New York, I'm thinking about, for example, how to make sure that communities that are dealing with high numbers of asthma cases, for example, that the air quality in those neighborhoods improves. So that means policies that really reduce car use over time in our cities. And I think those are the kinds of policy solutions that we're thinking about. So I'm going to be pushing for those pretty hard in the coming months.
Let's take a phone call. Karen in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hello, Karen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was saying I'd like to acknowledge the postal workers. The saying had go in sleet, rain, snow, sunshine, whatever. They're delivering the mail. I visited my postal office recently, and the only protective thing, in addition, they had their mask and their gloves on, but what was provided as a barricade is a clear shower curtain. And I'm saying these people are operating under these conditions, and I hear a lot about the frontline workers, and I'd like to really say thank you and acknowledge the postal workers. Thanks for taking my call.
Good one, Karen. Thank you for that. Let's go to Lauren in Brooklyn right away next. Lauren, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian, big fan. I just want to recognize all of the workers at my grandmother's nursing home in Kearny, New Jersey. I know we're talking a lot about how structurally they're not doing everything they can, but my grandmother's 91, and we found out she was infected with COVID about 3 weeks ago after obviously kind of expecting this statistically. But every day we get a call or a text about like a test that went well and her being asymptomatic. So they're just doing a great job there. And of course, my 91-year-old grandmother, who's a Portuguese immigrant, part of the vulnerable population, just refuses to quit. And she's just an amazing woman. So I want to recognize all of those women in the nursing home, my grandmother, and those that are helping her and us get through this.
Lauren, thank you so much. And Mara, my guest is Mara Gay, editorial board member of the New York Times. Isn't it interesting? I ask people to call and say what they're going to do on this weird Memorial Day weekend or who has passed they would like to mourn. And the first two callers call to express gratitude. And I was moved by the part of your article where you expressed your gratitude for your recovery, even though it's definitely not yet complete, as you describe, and expressed your feelings like that every conversation with an old friend brings a new rush of love now, or every sunny day feels like the first time you saw the ocean as a child. I mean, in normal times, you'd typically be too young at age 33 to have those kinds of feelings. Do you think this whole experience is changing your attitude toward gratitude?
I think it's certainly intensifying it, Brian. I've received help from, you know, old friends, close friends, and people I never met. I got a package the other day from a woman I met briefly on the campaign trail in Tennessee a couple months ago, which feels like a lifetime ago. And she sent me two handmade masks. One was Elvis themed because she's a Tennessee woman, and the other was Michigan themed because I went to the University of Michigan, and she just happened to know that about me. And receiving that kind of help and support, you know, there wasn't a day that went by when I was really sick where a friend wasn't dropping off some kind of grocery item or prescription or food for me. And I am, it really does make you want to cheer. And, you know, we're seeing the best and worst of humanity here. And when I say I want to pay it forward, I just... the thing I'm looking forward to most when I get better, fully better, is just figuring out how to bring that kind of support to people who just may not have the kind of family support or friend support that I do. And obviously, just you want to live your life every day to the fullest because you know that there are people who are your neighbors that didn't make it and don't get that second chance.
Hey Song in Bay Ridge wants to talk about Memorial Day weekend plans. Hi, Hey Song. Thanks for calling WNYC.
Hi, good morning. I do want to thank for also all the essential workers, especially people coloring in immigrant communities, especially that I'm also an immigrant. But I also want to talk about my possible plans. I guess that's not going to happen. Monday's my birthday this year.
Did you say today's your birthday?
No, Monday. The Memorial Day will be my birthday.
Oh, it happens to fall on your birthday. Yeah. That's not a cheery holiday to have coincide with your birthday.
Yes. So my relatives want to have a barbecue party on Sunday that I am not going to attend because I live in, like, you know, New York City, and they live in Jersey. But I thought it was really socially irresponsible to have a gathering at this time, especially if we don't have any veterans in our family. So yeah. I figured, like, I told them, like, this is not okay, and no one really seemed to understand why I was not attending. So I try to explain, like, I have a roommate, I have a cat, I have neighbors who are elderly and children, but unfortunately it's not getting through, and I think they'll be upset if I don't show up, but I do not plan to show up. I already accepted the fact that I will be spending birthdays alone this year, which is fine. It's different times, and, you know, times are changing as we go, but it was kind of frustrating to see that people are still, like, very lenient about the situation. So, yeah.
What is it about your decision that they don't get? Like,
I'm
do they
sure.
think they're not taking risks?
I think since because, like, everybody is, quote-unquote, quarantined, but we do have family members who are still working in the field. So, for me, like, I'm lucky enough to work from home. So that's why I was like, I mean, I do want to see my family and other relatives, but at the same time, like, we still have Zoom, we have FaceTime. Like, there's people who lost their families and friends, so I don't want to risk anybody. Just, like, I could be asymptomatic.
So, hey, Song, what are you going to do on your birthday? Anything special that you can come up with that's creative even while you're staying home?
Some of my friends already reached out and said that they want to do a Zoom call. And then, like, I know my sister will definitely call me, and that's all that matters to me. My boyfriend's been quarantined with me, so we'll spend it together too. So it's not completely alone. My roommate's here, so.
That's good. So you're not completely. Well, happy birthday, Hey Song. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
And call us again. And Mara, that tension that she described between herself, I mean, she kind of put it as a Bay Ridge versus Jersey thing. But you refer to this in your article. This is going on all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. I think we are all getting pretty weary of quarantine. And it's just not a normal human condition. People need fellowship. They need touch. They need hugs, and people want to see their grandkids and their parents. And so it can't go on forever. My plea is just, if you are living somewhere where people are opening back up, just take some reasonable measures and respect what this virus can do. Wear a mask, protect vulnerable people, and just do what you can. Take some reasonable measures. You know, I'm still here in New York, so I'm going to be quite socially distanced, and like, my plans for the weekend are I'm going to make one of those coronavirus pinatas, and maybe string it up somewhere and beat it. So, you know, I'm.
Are you really going to do that?
Yeah, I am. I am actually going to do that.
Do you put stuff in it?
We might put some candy in it, because why not? But. Yeah, no, I am doing that. I'm making it out of paper mache.
Put an extra piece of candy in for Hey Song's birthday.
I will, absolutely.
You know, the New York Post turned an opinion piece. I know, maybe it's bad form to ask a New York Times editorial writer about a New York Post editorial.
That's okay.
But they turned an opinion piece into a front page editorial yesterday aimed at Bill de Blasio. Quote, businesses can adjust. The elderly and infirm can continue to be isolated. It needs to end now. So I wonder how you react to that latest bit of, you know, conservatives want to reopen faster than progressives do. We thought that this was going on elsewhere in the country, maybe not in New York City.
Yeah, you know, I think my frustration is in part with the missing element in these arguments, which is, you know, often that I really think the reason that we are not able to open up like some other countries are, for example, Germany is kind of starting to step forward and open things up, is because we haven't had the kind of federal support for testing and other pandemic response measures that we really need to curb the virus quickly and effectively. And so I think there's a lot of kind of misdirected blame going on. But I do think that it's important that we do have a plan to reopen. And even though I don't think we're quite there yet in New York, and I think that the mayor and governor's measures for reopening, at least we do have some measure. So I think that's a good idea. We do need a plan to reopen. People cannot stay this way forever. And I really do understand the frustration. The thing I would say, though, is that just because you are not elderly or you are not sick in some way doesn't mean that you're not going to be hard hit by this virus. And I think my experience is not uncommon. There are a lot of people who become very, very sick who are not in high risk categories. So I just think that there's a lot of misunderstanding still about what this virus is and what it can do. And you also can look at the kids who've been getting sick. I mean, this horrible inflammatory disease yeah. that kids are getting. I mean, think about that. So I guess I'm frustrated with the lack of good faith on the part of some people. It seems like, there's not a lot of empathy or concern for themselves or others about what it could mean. The idea is to reopen, but to do it safely, obviously. And I'm not quite sure that's what the Post was calling for, but I can't read their mind.
A Memorial Day call. Chris in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, Brian. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Glad you're on.
I'm a registered nurse at Elmhurst Hospital. Started last March, and not March recently, March of 2019. And a lot of my coworkers have been there for many years, 20 years, 25 years, 15 years. So I'm kind of the new guy. And I just want to give remembrance to those staff who passed away, ancillary staff, people who helped transport labs when you called, people who helped clean. A lot of my coworkers knew these people for a long time and knew them better than me. And there were so many people that I didn't even know about that passed away that they would talk about throughout the pandemic. And I just wanted to give remembrance to those people. I'm a little nervous right now on the radio.
That's okay. But, and emotional. And it's right that you're emotional. And I'm so glad you're raising some of the usually invisible people who we do try to seriously include in our conversations on this show. So not only the nurses like yourself at a place like Elmhurst Hospital, but the people who are carrying supplies around and driving things around and the porters and things like that. That's who you're talking about.
Exactly.
Right?
And these people, they got a photo by the elevator for a few days or maybe a week, and then it was taken down. These people weren't protected as well as we were. I was a little bit more protected because I work in the neonatal ICU, and the babies were. I feel like we had enough N95s and stuff like that. But the other parts of the hospital were really hit hard, and especially those staff who weren't RNs, weren't doctors. You know, they didn't get masks, and they were more exposed transporting labs between the COVID floors and. You know, they were more exposed, and a lot of these people were close to retirement, and that's an even sadder part about it, that, you know, they worked for, mm-hmm. 40 years, 30 years.
And they get their retirement stolen from them.
Right, yeah.
Chris, are things better now at Elmhurst Hospital?
I think they are. I noticed that they are for sure. I have friends in other units. I have friends in the ER that I'm constantly talking to. They say, we have a lot more staff than we need now, and masks are better. And I would definitely say things are better. You just get that vibe from walking into the hospital. You know, it's funny coming into work now. People are taking photographs. You see like news agencies. You see like army people getting off of the buses. You see, people clapping. Yesterday, I was going into work, and there was a dad and his son in a car, and they were like clapping and cheering as we were walking in. And it's just emotional going into work now because it's kind of past the peak. Mm-hmm. I really think March and April were some of the worst months in New York City history, I would say. And I get emotional just thinking about it on March and April. Because I have a twin brother. He's an RN at NYU. Uh-huh. And so I'm kind of at this public hospital. He's at the private. So we've had, and he's actually on the front lines in the ICU. So we would both come home from work like, how was your day? How was your day? And it was some of the worst months I can remember in my life, for sure.
Do you want to say out loud what you learned, that some of the differences were between the private hospital and the public hospital? It's so poignant for you as twin brothers to be having these parallel experiences.
Well, it's just a lot. So it's crazy. He didn't have as much N95s as I did, and he's at NYU, and I'm at a public hospital. So that was one of the big things where, you know, I was like, Pam, how do I have a new N95 every day and you don't? And, but then he was getting better food than I was because they have very wealthy donors who, you know, he was showing me pictures of gourmet Italian meals and we were getting this, you know, our food wasn't as great. So that's just like another little difference. He was offered, their hospital is doing hazard pay, you know, where they're getting like a bonus. Our hospital hasn't announced that yet, but they did have this thing where they partnered with, I believe it's American Airlines and Hyatt to offer these free vacations later on in the year, if we can even get vacations at that time. So there's been these little subtle differences. But obviously, you know, he was really on the front lines in the ICU. And there's going back to your guests, I can't remember her name, but you mentioned Mara, I'm sorry about that. She mentioned people didn't really realize the dangers of to people who aren't even in the high-risk categories. My brother would tell me about these 20-year-old, 30-year-old people, Spanish people who look like the delivery people, totally healthy, and we're now on ECMO. And we're, you know, people don't realize that if you get a high viral load, it doesn't matter. He would come home every day telling me about these healthy looking people that probably celebrated New Year's this year and were healthy, and probably in January and February were perfectly fine and had families. But now in March and April were, you know, on ECMO and on a ventilator. So,
Chris, thanks for making your first call to the show such a meaningful one. Call us again, okay?
I appreciate it, Brian. Take care.
Thank you. Well, my guest is Mara Gay, New York Times editorial board member. Mara, what were you thinking listening to Chris?
Oh, it's hard. I mean, I was becoming emotional listening to him, but also just, you know, at the beginning of his call, talking about the porters, the janitors, the people who were left fairly exposed in his hospital. I think that is at the heart of why it is that so many people living in poverty and in Black and Hispanic communities have been hit so hard. I mean, so many of them are postal employees or essential workers, delivery people, janitors. And I think in terms of what we got wrong and what we need to do better, it's so clear. It's just getting PPE, that protective gear, not just to medical responders, but also to essential workers. And, you know, it's in a pandemic, you know, people are going to die and it's tragic no matter what. But I think what's hard for me is that the people who really didn't have to die, who were left unprotected because government failed them. And as someone who covers politics and just as a New Yorker, and a Black woman and an American, I see that in some ways as just, you know, the second tragedy and a crime.
Before you go, and we run out of time, I want to get to one other thing. You retweeted the Times article on the Columbia University study with the model showing that if the country had shut down just 1 week earlier, March 8th instead of March 15th, about 36,000 fewer people could have died. And that's been getting a lot of attention. And that goes not just for federal policy, but for New York State and New York City, too. Here's Governor Cuomo reacting to the finding yesterday by basically asking, who, me?
Who should have known? It's above my pay grade as governor of one state. But what federal agency, what international health organization? I don't know. It's not what I do. It's not my responsibility.
And here's Dr. Anthony Fauci on Morning Edition today, seeming to say even at his pay grade, there were unknowns before they decided to act, even though we assume now people would have been saved.
So you make a reasonable assumption. Well, you know, if we had done that sooner, we would have prevented more infections and we would have prevented more deaths. That is true. But at the time, it was not clear that that was the case. So, of course, we always could have done better, particularly when you look in the rearview mirror and do a retrospectoscope and say, wow, you know, we could have saved a lot of disease if we had done it much earlier.
Dr. Fauci on Morning Edition on NPR today. Mara, I actually find this story and the whole blame game kind of complex. And I'll lay it out, you know, a little bit more in a second. But how much blame do you want to give to officials here compared to other countries where they did act earlier? I remember right. talking on the show when there were I think there were 200 cases and no deaths in Japan. I think I'm remembering the numbers right, when they shut down the schools nationwide. But, you know, New York officials, Cuomo, de Blasio, Trump's in another category, but none of them are doing it. And listen to what even Dr. Fauci said. Oops, did we just lose Mara's line?
I'm here.
Oh.
Hi, sorry, yeah, I lost you for a second. Yeah, okay. I think there's a lot more reporting that I would like to do about how this all unfolded before we do a final accounting. But I really think that the biggest mistake that you see running through the White House, the State House, all of the State Houses except for maybe in California, and in the city, is that it seems that all of the strongest voices from the public health community, that health officials, were sidelined. And I think that is maybe the single biggest mistake that officials made, is we had health officials here in New York, in the city and the state, who said, we need to shut this down now. And they were sidelined, is what it appears. And if that's the case, then that's a huge mistake.
But here's part of why I find it complicated. And for me, Trump is in his own category. He only sure. cares about keeping his numbers down and how it looks over the next news cycle. But an article in The Times on March 13th with the headline, De Blasio stays firm on keeping New York City schools open as outbreak spreads, says in the body of the article, even public health experts with dissenting views on whether entire school systems should be closed say that to be effective in protecting public health, such moves should be long-term, ideally for as long a threat like the novel coronavirus persists. The Federal Centers for Disease Control said on Friday, and, you know, we're talking about like March 12th there, whatever that Friday was, quote, short to medium closures did not have an impact on mitigating the spread of the virus, but the closings of 8 to 20 weeks might have some impact. The CDC also said, and this line made me sit up when I reread it this morning. The CDC also said that other countries that closed schools did not necessarily have more success in curbing the virus's spread than those that did not. So does the Times' own reporting on this at the time let public officials off the hook from too much hindsight yeah. recrimination?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you're absolutely right. It is complicated. And by the way, there's a saying in disaster recovery, which is you're building the plane midair. So it's very easy to be a Monday morning quarterback here. And I recognize that. And the school situation is even more complicated because there were a lot of health officials I spoke to months ago who said that actually we could do more harm than good, quote, closing down the schools. But I think my concern is that we have two of the best health departments in the world, in the New York State and New York City Health Department. The New York City Health Department is a department that has dealt with Ebola, that helped curb the AIDS epidemic. And so I think, you know, they were sidelined. It's quite clear that they were sidelined. So why it is that they were sidelined and essentially silenced when they seemed to, by the way, they were right. Turns out they were right, we now know, to push the city and the state to close earlier. That is the problem, because, you know, that's why they're there. They are in government to advise, to make the safest and best public health policy. And I really think that that was a serious mistake that was made by the governor and the mayor. But there's plenty of time for that. And then there were other mistakes made. I mean, I think one of the ways we got this wrong was in hardening the hospitals, but not other infrastructure. For example, community health clinics, the decisions to shut those down right away, I think, unfortunately, has caused us to lose more lives than we had to lose here in New York. The decision to assume that most people who are not in high risk categories wouldn't need any medical help and could stay home. The PSAs we have that we continue to see from the federal government telling people to just stay home, don't go to the emergency room, call your doctor first. I mean, if you can't breathe, you need to go to an ER. There are people who need help, and you don't want them to wait until it's too late. And so there are a lot of lessons here. But I do think the sidelining of the health departments is at the heart of the story.
Mara Gay, New York Times editorial board member. Mara, you sound like you're feeling much better, but listeners, I recommend you to Mara's article in the Times, which describes how even for her as a healthy, no pre-existing conditions, 33-year-old runner could get hit so hard by the coronavirus and the lessons from that for personal activity and for public policy. Mara, thank you for sharing some of this with us.
Thanks for having me. Happy Memorial Day weekend.
You too.